right, welcome back, Red Ice members. We are talking with Michael Tesserian. We've been primarily going into our conversation about control, government, and basically what man's role is in all of this. We've been discussing Walden 2, Calvinism, and kind of how these different philosophies from Hegel and others have kind of led up to the situation that we're in today. But you were ending on one note there, Michael, in terms of basically the face that we turn towards the unconscious is something that will be reflected back towards us. And I guess the dilemma here then is that if you show a happy face towards that, you expect happy things and good things, positive things to come back to you. But it also seems to me then that it's brutally honest, meaning that if you show a fake happy smile to it, you're not going to get you're going to get the fraudulent version back. Maybe you can talk a little bit about this, Michael.
Well, that's what's happening. That is exactly the danger of this, pump it till it hurts sort of positivism that has crept in through the New Age and through the motivational speakers, and is the bane. Of course, it goes without saying. I mean, if you just apply common sense, if you apply common sense to anything, it's usually excellent. And if you apply common sense to this, obviously a man should be in his true emotions. He should be not afraid to show tears when he's sad. He should not fear to show anger or repress these things, you know, within reason, of course. And he should definitely not be smiling, you know, when he's not feeling a whole person or satisfied or content. And you know that it's just a idiom of life that, you know, we always ask, hey, how you doing? You know, and everybody says, yeah, I'm fine, when they could be going through living hell, you know. So there's this hypocrisy element, and it's become so ubiquitous that it's one of the things that's preventing people from having a relationship with this unconscious. Because if you look at the unconscious, as I do, as being the reservoir of nature's tuition to you, which you are now very estranged from, not the Rilkes and not the Blakes and the Heideggers and so on, but the most of us are. We're very, very alienated from this. And by being alienated, as we said in the previous part, that helps you to become vulnerable, and then you can be easily controlled by the system with all of these tigers in the long grass. You're also going to be hoping that those tigers will then lead you out of the jungle, and that's what these religious Pied Pipers are doing. And it may be even what these other motivational types are also to do. I think that, like I said, the positive aspect is they may be a reaction to the old dour, you know, puritanical status quo, but they also may be sort of tigers trying to lead you further and further into illusion, because if you're not coming from a true sense of emotion, you're coming from this Hegelian aspect in which the society is the one that is molding your emotional behavior, and your emotional equilibrium is totally tied into the social hive, then if the social hive starts creating these very false models, right, the sort of Deepak Chopra stroke, you know, Wayne Dwyer, PBS, you know, Tony Robbins rubbish, You'll do it too, because, of course, now you have to do it, because if you don't, what happens? They don't like you at work, Henrik, because you're real negative, man.
Gotcha. That's incredible.
So what is that? They are a reaction to the Calvinistic form of fascism, that if you smiled or had sex or smelt a rose, you were going to hell. And they've set up now their own version of fascism, where if you don't smile on cue and you're not wearing yellow all day long, or you're wearing black or a heavy metal t-shirt, and, you know, you kind of just keep to yourself and you always look at you're using your brain, in other words, you're using your critical apparatus. Hey, man, you're over-intellectualized. You're too negative. And so a new form of totalitarianism, a new form of tyranny rises in the East. You know, this is what is happening, or in this case, rises in the West.
Yeah. So that also kind of explains that it stems from the Hegelian dialectic as well, in that sense, because we've had one version previously, and now we're being offered the counterweight to that, but it's not any more sincere than the previous one, right? We're still in that dilemma, and that connects with that idea that we're still showing a fake version of ourselves and also our interpretation of reality towards the unconscious. So the effect of that we get back is a insincere society, and things are going down the drain instead, you know?
That's right. As we said, if you show fear, it's really very practical. If you show fear, and threat and all of that kind of emotion, anxiety, to the unconscious, and that means to the mystery, or to fate, because nature and the unconscious are made out of the same stuff. So you show it to the world, and to that extent, the prosperity cult, you know, the secret and all of that, is rooted in what philosophers have been saying for years. They've just reinvented it and are sort of they're repackaging something that is very profound, and that is that don't show faces of lack and poverty and fear to the world or to your own self. That's all legitimate. There's nothing New Age about it. That's a fact. But by that same definition, if you can show fear to it and then you meet demons, it implies that if you show fearlessness and strength and courage and love and understanding, you will meet angels. But the problem is, because we're so now in the persona, we are so conditioned by what the society is all about, it can break that down and you can end up showing this sort of inauthentic, pseudo sort of sane face, you know. And then that is what is happening. That's why in the New Age movement, you get so many people who are about as false as you could possibly imagine, with a big smile on their face, pretending that they're all centered and with it. And actually, these are some of the most seething creatures, you know, that you'd ever want to, you know, they're really, really dark souls in a way. And it's because they're not integrating their unconscious at all.
You know, ultimately, we have the overarching idea that we're talking about here is basically controlled, and the idea of being owned, human beings as being more like robots than anything. We've been talking about the behaviorists and the Calvinists and that things stem from these philosophies. But we can also tie these different things together then if we move into talking more about the Constitution Con, for instance, because then, again, here we have this idea that you're being owned through legalese or through documentation or through bureaucracy and things like that. And so out of a society that kind of endorses these things, it's not that big of a leap, actually, of moving from an old Calvinist model into a new model where the Constitution con rules us. Right, Michael?
Yeah, it's all to do with the technocratic man. If you're subservient to a community, a society of elites who literally are convinced that man has no consciousness, has no soul, and you buy into it and you're part of this hive, then you are basically an object. At that point, you become a simulacra of a man. You are basically a replica of what a man was once upon a time in his life. You have almost no connection to nature. In fact, look at our cities. We never see the moonlight as the moonlight is. We never see the starlight as it is, because the lights are on morning, noon, and night.
Yep.
And so our connection to nature in many, many ways is utterly shattered and broken. And you become an object. And therefore, now that you are a product, this is what opens this whole can of worms into the legalese and into the whole corporatization of your being. You are literally now just the ultimate slave, because you have no self-will at all. And you'll be told where to go and where to work. And this is what opens then technical man, the technological man. Technological man is different from technical man. Technical is good. Technical is the invention of the computer, you know, and the intelligence and inventiveness of people to make television and phones and telephones and so on. Technical is not what I'm talking about. That's a beautiful thing that man has created. But technological has a broader, you know, philosophical definition that means basically the sort of corporatized mechanical person whose thinking is just like a robot or a machine, is conformist. And then that individual can then be further controlled through this whole disempowerment of sovereignty. Mm. You have no psychic sovereignty, is basically what it boils down to. You have no moral sovereignty. So there's no chance that you're ever going to then find it, you know, in the communities that are built by such people. And the ultimate tyranny of that, the ultimate concomitant of that, is these oligarchical controls that are basically in place, you know, the federal systems and all of these other versions of legal means of controlling your nature. I mean, Thomas Paine, again, he said, the government of England is as great, if not the greatest perfection of fraud and corruption that ever took place since governments began, is what you cannot be a stranger to unless the constant habit of seeing it has blinded your senses. So he says that, you know, the governments, like, he was the one who said that if the people are free, there's no need for government.
Yeah.
And he said that the English government, and this is where all of the different laws come from, It's not only Vatican law and the canon law and the maritime law, but it's mostly coming out of Britain, out of the whole Freemasonic structures there that is then infiltrated America through the federal system of the Constitution. People need to be very aware of this, that there's a big difference between laws and rules. There's a difference between what is lawful and what is legal, corporate and sovereign and so on. They need to be very familiar with this. It's part of the extraction process. It's part of the empowerment process of understanding. And what you see, to me, these things that we're living in the physical life are not disconnected from our spiritual journey. So you might think, oh, I'm just doing this legal stuff. What's that got to do with it? Or, you know, get even down. I don't want to dabble into politics. That's all too dark. What you don't understand, is people who think like that don't understand, is that, look, that is part of your journey towards selfhood. It's part of it.
What about constitution and declaration? There's a few different things there in terms of both what the terms mean, but there's also different dates associated with it. Tell us about that, Michael.
Yeah, isn't it incredible that, well, see, in my opinion, as I've written in the Constitution Con, the Constitution left the door wide open to tyranny and to oligarchy coming in. That was one of our, you know, critiques of what Alex Jones, you know, was talking about in the fall of the Republic, and a lot of the patriots who believe that just by getting back to the Constitution is going to be sort of this save all and solve all. This is absolutely unfounded. And I don't bother going into the reasons why they think that. It's just, it is that way. And this is another big piece of what I've gone into and written about. The very word tyranny, for instance, literally, if you look it up in the dictionaries of the time, don't look it up in a modern dictionary, look it up at the time when the Constitution was written, get a dictionary from that era, and you will see the definition of tyranny is unlimited power. Mm-hmm. Anyone who has unlimited power over you. And the definition of sovereignty was unrestricted by any other.
Mm-hmm.
So sovereignty literally meant total freedom, not absolute power from any force over you, but the Constitution that people have signed on for, because again, they won't read it properly, they won't look into these matters, gave the government the absolute power. Tyranny is absolute power, and it was Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. So people just need to remember that 1, 8, 17, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of the Constitution, it said that Congress shall have the power to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever.
And but just want to put this in there for everyone who is in Europe right now, that that's exactly what's happening with the Lisbon Treaty and the European Union. So we're seeing the United States of Europe being formed right in front of our eyes, and we have this opportunity again to see when this is happening and when this is taking place. They have legislative power, you know, up the, you know, tons more than they had before, and we're going to see so many more laws now coming into place in Europe. So just our European audience, keep that in mind.
That's right. And it's no different from America, because that was the experiment. America was the experiment to see how this would work so that they could come back to the people in Europe who were a little bit onto this hundreds of years ago and didn't want this. And the monarchy had to step back a bit because there was just so much tyranny going on. So then the American experiment, you know, you have to look at it historically again. You have the American experiment. Then they hone their tools, they hone their skills, and then they can now apply it to this, the countries of Europe. They've done it in many, many other ways by, like we say, after the First World War and Second World War, dividing up Europe, pitting groups against one another, undermining sovereignty, creating all of these terrorist organizations, creating all of these religions that ultimately believe in the same God but yet are murdering and fighting each other. There's 101 ways that they do this. But the most immediate way, and why I go into this legal stuff, is because, you see, it's through the legal mechanisms that you can gain your power back. You've had people like John, what was his name?
John Harris.
John Harris, you see. You have Maynard. You have a bunch. If people go to my forum and go to the What's New page, and also go to Mankind's Future page, you'll have all the links there that, you know, get into this, who are the institutions that exist, which are the better systems, and so on. We have it on the forum. We have it there.
Is it,
under the,
Michael,
under Mankind's Future.
Are you talking about basically the free man on the land, that kind of idea?
That's
that
right.
You can write yourself out of the system, etc.?
And you do it through empowerment, not fear. You do it through strengthening your own, making it an adventure. In the idea that you can use the very systems that these Templars and Cardinals and that the bureaucrats use. You can use the same bureaucracy. It's written in the bureaucracy. This is what people have to understand. It's not something controversial. It's not something fringe. It's not something wacko jacko. Within the very articles of the legal leviathans, in the very documents that they've created, are the loopholes that allow you, if you know what you're doing, in a simple technical way, to gain the power back, a power at work, power, you know, in the possessions that you own, and power in court, and power against any form of petty tyranny, you know, that comes to control your rights. And if many people, because remember, everyone is always talking, are they not? It's absolutely ubiquitous, isn't it? That everyone's talking about, when are we going to be able to do anything? When are we going to wake up the whole mankind? Yeah. When?
Right.
Well, listen, if people really sincerely want that, then there is only one way to do it. If you're an advocate of collective action, and you can never rule it out, I'm not a big fan of it, but you can never rule it out, then my goodness, what other ways are possible? You certainly can't do it in the political pigsty. That's been designed so that you can never have any real lasting change. But within the law, you can. And that's why this is very, very important to know. Mm-hmm. I mean, for instance, this whole thing about executive legislation in all cases whatsoever in the Constitution, it's the same phrase that appeared in the Declaration of Independence. And it was used by the Founding Fathers to expressly define the tyrannical power that is exercised by King George, the sworn enemy of Americans. So wait a minute. In one breath, they're telling you that they're against the executive legislation in all cases whatsoever, because that term defined the power that King George, the tyrant, had, right, over Americans.
Right.
But then they introduce it in the next document as something they are going to do. So the Founding Fathers gave the Congress the same tyrannical powers as the King of England, which is always my point. Who do they think they're working for? They're working for those guys. The Benjamin Franklins and all these people were basically agents of the British Crown, but they were like the Fabian. The Fabian logo, as you well know, is the sheep in, is the wolf in sheep's clothing.
Indeed.
And that's what they, it's not just an emblem, a logo. They literally have done this. And most of the signers of the Constitution were what?
Oh, Freemasons, obviously.
Right.
Yes.
Right. And they were the same men. Most of the signers of the Constitution were the same men who signed the Declaration of Independence. Mm. And the Constitution restricted the Congress's tyrannical power, right? This is the Constitution restricted it to the, again by the wording, to the District of Columbia and Washington, is where all the federal orgs, you see, are rooted.
Yes, the microstate of District of Columbia.
Right, which is controlled from England. And the Vatican has a power as well. But that, in a way, is a little bit of a loophole, because by having these tyrannical powers, this absolute power, at least it was restricted to the federal area. It's only later on, by complicity of human beings, that they forgot this, and then these federal agents were able to then infiltrate all of the different states with their own people until you have the mess that you've got today. But the thing is that the United States of America, that term, and the United States are two forms of constitutional government in America, with the latter one being the tyrannical body. It's the United States, that terminology is tyrannical. That's applying to the federal agents. And the United States of America was a term that, you know, applied to the free men of the states. So what you basically had was two constitutions. This is what people don't understand. You've got two, just by the simple wording of these articles. And we have the links, and we'll put them up on the site so people can thoroughly understand this. So that in 1865 and in 1868, after the Civil War, when the 13th, you know, and 14th Amendments were written down and passed, it was the 13th Amendment that made it possible for Americans to be voluntary slaves. The only kind of slavery, Henrik, that the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence forbid is involuntary servitude. Meaning
that
they cannot come to your door, grab you, put chains around you like a black, and take you down to the cotton fields. That was rendered null and void for white men by the Constitution. But if you want to say, can I please become a slave? Can
sure.
I serve you?
Sign right up.
Oh, by all means.
Yeah.
Here's your chains of gold. Here's your stipend. Here's your pig pen. And get on with it. And that is what has happened.
Do you, Michael, think that this ultimately boils down to the fact that parents sign away their children to the state when they're born through the birth certificate and so forth, or does it go deeper than this? Is it more things that people sign that gets you deeper into this bureaucratic mess? Or
that's the first one. Everything you sign from a parking ticket, you know, to a contract at work with a boss, and all of the above, houses, all of the rest of it.
Yeah.
And remember, it's okay to be doing that. If you really, we don't want to get into too much of the actual step-by-step stuff, because first of all, I'm not the expert on it. I just researched it, but I can tell people where to go for the people who really have the tremendous specific knowledge. But one thing I can say is that it doesn't mean that you don't have to sign it. It's just that you don't have to, you strengthen yourself. It's in the same description as I've always talked about with psychic immunity. The man who is psychically immune cannot be affected. He doesn't have to go and kill anyone. He doesn't have to go out and fight the government. If he is psychically immune, he cannot be invaded. It's the same thing this way. If you're legally immune, then even these people can serve these papers on you, and you have the legal power to simply in contractual ways, without any loss of energy, without any anger, without any defensiveness, without any loss of power, without any hidden agendas or anything like that, you can simply in a contractual way say no.
Yeah.
Through a legal procedure that can be done in a very, very specific way. But yes, with a birth certificate and your parents' ignorance, you see, of course, that is signing you on to basically be a debt slave onto these systems. And it's the same in America as it is for Britain.
Oh, yeah, it's in the UK too, the same thing there?
Same thing there, yeah. And in fact, it even says on those birth certificates, you know, that you are basically a human resource.
Huh. How about that?
But the 14th Amendment is interesting too, because it's the one that introduced the word person instead of people. Mm. Remember in the Constitution, at least it said at the top, we the people?
Yes.
That was later altered again through this legalese, through this sleight of hand. And the 14th Amendment introduces this strange word person that is completely not what people think it means. People are sovereign with these unalienable rights, but persons are the ones who live under government-granted privileges. It's a difference. So when they say oh, you're a person, legally, this is what it means, that you are the willing slave. You have you're the slave by consent. Because remember, again, I repeat that only involuntary servitude was declared illegal by these documents, but not voluntary servitude. That was made perfectly okay. So the and of course, a right legally is not the same thing as a privilege. And the latter, this is a privilege, allows us to act only after permission has been granted. Mm. And what Maynard says, he's an expert in this. He says that when you ask for permission for everything, you've just defined yourself as a child.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and he says that in Canada, they even have a statement where they ask you, a policeman can ask you, are you a child of the province?
Oh, my God. Really?
Right. Yeah, Jordan Maxwell has pointed out that Black's Law Dictionary under citizen, it says monster.
That's right. That's right. That's
non-entity.
Sheesh.
So why are we going into this? Because it ties back to what we said on the first section here. Child, monster, no soul, no individuality.
Yeah, exactly.
You have no mind. We own you. You have no. See, these one things connect to the other. People who are listening for the first time think, where are we going with all of this? One thing connects to the other. These are the bricks in the cell. These are the bars on the door. You know, in fact, it may not even points out why lawyers are called members of the bar. Is because the bars are the bars of the prison that keep you in one box and the controllers in the other box. It's incredible when you get into all of this.
Yeah.
But see, the thing is this, that the sovereigns of the world don't need to ask permission on how to run their lives, right? They claim that only God can remove the rights of the people and all of this.
Yeah.
But when you have a privilege, then that privilege can be taken away by those who've granted it.
And even their, sorry to cut you off, but even their kind of ruthless attitude towards other people reflects this mentality as well, because again, they don't ask anybody if they can put, you know, mercury in their vaccines or whatever it is that,
that's right,
you know, that they're doing. They just do the things that they do, and then consequently, we're the ones who might, out of, you know, kindness and so forth, are asking, is this okay? Can we do, can I do this? Is it allowed if I do that or the other? But what you're saying here, then, that's actually, that's part of the legal legalese, pretty much, that you're asking for permission for everything, having a certificate or a license to drive a car, etc. There's multiple, you know, examples we can take.
And do you see the nuance? They have the perfect right to do that. Everyone that wants to fight the system is screaming, and I mean everyone, is screaming about how dare they do this? What's on their mind? What are we going to do? Drag them down, bring them down, and nothing gets done. Hmm. My philosophy is let them go ahead and do that. If they want to put something in the law or they want to do this and thing, you let them do it. It's a Taoist principle to give evil a lot of room. Hmm. And as you said, it does go quite deep. There's a philosophy behind that. All Taoists, and I use that word specifically, Taoists, which is people who know what the hell is life is all about, give they know that evil contains within it the seeds of its own destruction. So if something is going to fall, get the hell out of the way.
Yeah, that's right.
And there's a secondary plus about doing that. It's the same plus that you do when some drunk comes over at 12 o'clock at night and wants to, like, you know, tell you his life story about 2 inches away from your face. You know, or when some bully comes up in a bar and wants to shove a beer bottle in your face. You get out of the way.
Yeah.
When you see something that's corrupt and malicious and rotten, you step aside and let it do whatever it wants to do. You disempower it by disconnecting. I don't mean disconnecting like a bunch of jaded middle-class guys living in a suburb. Like, well, I just don't want to know about it. Turn the channel. That's not what I mean. Mm-hmm. I mean a positive, proactive, intelligent, aware, and totally centered detachment from the conflict, because all vampires feed on the energy that you give them.
Mm. That's
right. And we haven't got time to go into this whole paradigm here, but that's what I mean by stepping away from it. Let them do it. Because when you have the legal power, in your own quiet moment, you can rebut it. But the people who don't want to go and learn about that legal power will get up right into the face of the system, and like some crazed out Bill O'Reilly on speed, and just want to, you know, drag it down and fight it and kill it and do it. And you know all that does? It helps them strengthen their rules, which is exactly the draconian New World Order situation that you've got now, where everybody who's been fighting the system in that way is going to be in trouble, big trouble. Big Brother is coming after you. They've got your number, and they're going to, you've actually assisted them in getting this far, because you haven't done what is holistic. You haven't stepped into your own power. You haven't contacted the forces, like Charles Lindbergh said, will be there when you open yourself to the mystery, you know, like when he was flying his plane across the Atlantic. These men of mystery, these men of science, these men of artistry knew Aikido. They knew how to step aside. You know, Bruce Lee, become like water, my friend, right?
Yeah.
The wisdom that underlies all of this is the softest and the weakest and the gentlest thing in the world, but it can erode continents is water. That's the power that you need to embody. That is the only way that you can gain the so-called spiritual direction. The moment that you go into a vibration of conflict, anger, and I mean red anger, there's actually, again, anger's been misinterpreted, so, but I don't want to get into that right now. Just let's use the word. The red anger, any of these lower vibrations which are born out of survival and limbic responses, you see, and this whole reptilian brain thing, that is only going to empower those people, because that's ultimately what they want.
Mm. Well, that's a very good point, because again, fighting the New World Order in that sense ain't going to help, because that's by the way they bring in more laws and put more police on the streets, the more rioting. That's why they even put in their own agents provocateurs in many of these peaceful demonstrations, because they know if they can stir it up enough, then they can, next time they have a top meeting of politicians or bankers or what have you, instigate even more control and put up more cameras and all of these things, you know.
So which they've been doing.
Yeah.
We're living in it. We have made it. The man who does not occupy his center, they teach it in every martial arts course. It's a fundamental of Taoism, somewhat of Zen. There's some obscure aspects of Hinduism, like Jainism, and not all Jainism, but certain aspects of Jainism teach this. Certain, most shaman classes would teach this. The Druids certainly taught this. And it's a universal law. Once you are so strong in your own sovereignty, in your own understanding, you never need to confront. In fact, it's the last thing you want to do. It's a spiritual law that's very, very difficult to understand, but it's fundamental. You disengage, and you, by ignoring the rants of this bestial thing, you disempower it. And your final and part of that strengthening of your own immunity is this legalistic empowerment, using their own system against them in a very cold, calculating way in which you use their own power. Why do you think I talk so much about psychology? Because I always emphasize that they're the ones who know all about your psychology, just like we were saying.
Yeah, yeah.
So you need to learn it, because that's what we talked about in the DVD as well. You need to get up to speed on it like nobody's business, because they are using these psychological powers over you. It was the same thing with the legal. Now, how many times, again, I reiterate this, how many times have you heard people say, when are we going to do this? What are we going to do? How do we fight them back? On talk shows, on radio shows, on podcasts and books, in the streets. Everyone is telling you that they need to fight back, and that one person tells you how.
Hmm. Yeah.
Because there's something about this consensus trance or even the collectivism. Do you realize that there is a collectivism? And again, this is another thing nobody ever mentions. In the conspiracy movement, you will die before you will hear anyone mention that there's something negative about the collectivism, even of the alternative research community.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, this goes for blogs, webcasts, and YouTube and all of these things. The collectivist aspect of it is also no better than the collectivism that, you know, will disempower you in 100 other ways.
Mm.
So it's going to exist. It's going to be there. But people should also realize, you know, let's not completely think it's always going to be about a mass movement doing X, Y, and Z.
Sure, sure.
It comes down to what you're going to do. But when you hear all of these people complain about what needs to be done, but they never offer you the solution, or those who are offering you the solution usually don't even know that there's a conspiracy going on. You also have that problem too. Like there's some sort of, you know, mad lunatic professor type who knows all about the legalese, but you could never convince them that there's a world government or anything like that. Well, you know, that you have these disconnects as well. But again, you know, I always support that. And I've always done so, you know, with whether it's incorporating your name or stepping right outside of the system, you know, and getting this sort of legal empowerment, which can be done, is a fantastically empowering thing. You may never even have to use it, but at least you know that you have the great power to use it. It's like every martial artist will tell you, if they're like a first dan or second dan or third dan, and they can knock you out just with your elbow, they never attract conflict in their lives because they're walking knowing that they're so strong and powerful, you know, they can be 4 foot high. These people never get into conflict. Because they're already so empowered, you see.
Yeah.
It just doesn't come their way.
Okay, that covers a little bit on in terms of the extended conversation on the Constitution Con. There is one thing that we want to talk a little bit more about here, Michael, and that goes into the, basically continues on the thread of psychic sovereignty and how to attain that. But death instinct is another factor here too. It's a psychological phenomenon, I guess. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about this and what your take on this is, and how important this is in terms of understanding the situation we're in, Michael.
Well, this ties back to Freud and the whole question of the ego and the repression. Freud, in his last works, decided that there was, of course, the life instinct, which is having children and feeling positive towards the world, and everything grows and everything gets created. But he noticed that there was also this counterpointing energy, which is he eventually called Thanatos, the death instinct, in which is there's also a property in matter and a property in consciousness that basically doesn't want to grow, doesn't want to live. It becomes static, it becomes morbid, and it falls back into inertia. You know, dust gathers on a table, rust gathers on a piece of metal. There's certain entropy. Nature is also pulling things back into the void. There's a deconstructive model. And Freud's term for this was after the Greek god Thanatos. And he also said that it happens in the mind. With a morbid soul who's been brutalized and terribly hurt, it's like a form of regression. Because there's repression and then there's regression. Regression is that when life becomes so horrible for you, that living in the now, living in the present becomes so bad, a safety mechanism is to return, not physically, but psychically, to a previous state of consciousness, in which you were safer. And this thing called regression accounts for an enormous amount of human behavior, incredible to study it. And the death instinct is a much more morbid version of that, in which the person not only now regresses to a previous state, they basically stop. All forms of life force slowly fade. And then you have this, again, morbid, you know, basically vacant, very manipulatable, vulnerable type of person walking around. And so Freud elaborated, you see, on his theories. And then his very close friend and associate, Otto Rank, who is one of the greatest psychologists who ever lived, he changed it a little bit. And this figures a lot in my work and my interpretations, is the theories of Otto Rank, in which he said that, no, the Thanatos is not so much as Freud defined it, as this mysterious sort of almost mystical, metaphysical, you know, inertia, or some sort of recalcitrant energy, you know, that sort of holds the life force back or whatever. He believed that the Thanatos instinct is what you see when you look out into the world as it is.
Mm.
And this might not sound like a lot to people, but it's actually a tremendous discovery. He said that the Thanatos instinct is not some mysterious state which is almost imperceptible. It is actually what you see when you look at the state of inauthentic man in their lives, in their marriages, in their places of work, behind their cubicles in this sort of Fight Club type scenario, trapped in their suits, sitting in traffic, eating the garbage food, listening to the false misleaders, living inauthentic lives. He goes, there is your Thanatos instinct. It doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. Freud theorized about it and said it existed, but he was vague as about how it actually forms. Rank said, I can see it when I open my door. There it is. It's in people's faces. It's in their lives. The morbid energy is the man who is living, but who is self-murdered, self-killed. And this is absolutely phenomenally important. Eric Fromm, another psychologist, he referred to it as the necrophiliac. Again, these terms are used in a slightly different context than we know them. The necrotic man, the necrophiliac person whose life just becomes an endless, you know, repetition and just football games and pornography and just food and sweet food and gossip and rubbish. This is the person who is basically is dead. He's not living a true life because any sense of authenticity, any sense of individualism is completely crushed and gone. And then you pick up later on with the existential psychologists like Viktor Frankl, and they're saying that, look, the drive of life, the primal under drive, is not, as Freud said, a sexual motivation or pleasure. It's meaning. Frankl, you know, was a Freudian, but he changed it a bit. And he said that the real essence of man, the real motivation that keeps his life force going, his eros, is the search for meaning. And then it means that if that ever gets stymied or ever gets shut down, there will be disappointment. Hmm. There will be tremendous disaffection. And the person will then become neurotic. For those who are not familiar with anything to do with psychology, I can give a very clear explanation of what psychology is in a nutshell. All psychologists, I mean the big wigs, the ones who really, you know, created it and who have a legitimate reason to be called that, mm-hmm. all psychologists by definition must have a theory of neurosis.
Okay.
They study human beings, right? But if they didn't deal with man's dementia, and if they didn't deal with the weird mental aberrations that human beings have, they'd just be sociologists. Sociologists traditionally study mankind in movements in society, right?
Right.
A psychologist is slightly different. He's a sociologist, but he focuses on derangement. He focuses on abnormal traits. And by doing so, they therefore have to have a theory of neuroses. And that's what you find. If you read Jung, if you read Freud, if you read Adler, if you read Horney, if you read, you know, Rank, and you read Viktor Frankl, you see, or Eric Fromm or R.D. Lang or any of these people, that's what you're looking at. You're trying to find out what is their particular theory for the reason why men are do the crazy, sadistic, mad, self-sadistic, and masochistic things that they do. And of course, each psychologist has a different theory, or some of them are very similar, or some are a little bit of a twist on one, and some are radically different. Some are very radically different. Mm-hmm. And this is what defines a psychologist, and people should know this. But this redefining of the Thanatos instinct is a huge, huge piece of it, because it explains something very, very important. And that is that the inauthentic man who's walking around in the world, but he's self-murdered, he hates himself. But he then may create a perfect public persona, right, in the world that makes him look completely adjusted. Mm. Now, I've said in my work so many times before that the schizophrenic or the schizoid person will create a schizogenic society. The toxic man, yeah, will create a toxic society. But if society is saying, oh, listen, you don't have to worry about that. As long as you present the socially acceptable, acculturated face, we don't give a damn if you're self-murdered or what you do in your spare time, so to speak. As long as you're a functionary and can get up and work and do whatever you need to do, we don't care if you have to take pills. We don't care if you live a life of misery. We don't care if you've got millions of distractions. And we don't care if you bring misery to everybody who's got the misfortune of coming into your life. Hmm. You see how one, again, ties to the other?
Yeah, and it's all about keeping the machine going, pretty much. And it doesn't matter if the workarounds are unhappy when they're in the, you know, or what emotional state they're in, as long as they, as you say, can perform their duties and keep the machinery going, then it doesn't matter to the machine in that sense.
And what the danger is that we now are living in a society that is basically wall-to-wall sociopathic for these reasons. It happens gradually, but this is what is taking place. People are losing their roots. People know this, but they have very weak, in my opinion, critiques. They mostly have sociological critiques, or they have some basic Christian, you know, just get back to some family values, and some barbecues, and everything will be okay again, you know. And all these things, they have very topical explanations. Oh, it's the economy, you know, and this and that and the other, or it's too much technology. No, no, no. The real problems are psychological. And until people get rooted into what that is and find out what these things are, they're never going to be able to understand what psychopathy is and what schizophrenia is. The society makes people schizophrenic because it asks you to just have this public persona that fits into what is needed and what is desired, and the rest be damned. A person does, and the same thing in their relationships. You know, the ratings of approval and jumping through the hoops and, you know, all these codependent sort of situations that have arisen is very, very deadly. And also, again, I guess I probably should say a few words to define what a schizophrenic person is, if we have time.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Basically, in psychological parlance, it's very fascinating. A schizophrenic person, and remember, I believe that most people are like this, so it's kind of important. A schizophrenic person is a stranger to himself.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine, for instance, that Arno Gruen, a psychologist, likes to refer to it as the betrayal of the self. When a soul, a child, cannot meet the approval of its parents or that society, it hates itself. It thinks there's something, it doesn't believe that there's something wrong with the father figure or the society, because that's considered taboo. Right? Mm-hmm. For some strange reason, you don't strike back at the object of the real problem. You blame yourself. And when the blame becomes extremely severe, then you basically, I refer to it as being self-murdered. And Gruen talks about it as being, you know, the self-betrayed individual. And or Fromm calls it the necrophiliac person. And again, that's the Thanatos instinct at work. Well, this individual has lost all sense of subjectivity. In other words, the way you and I and most of the people listening to this think of themselves, they have this idea of selfhood. When you think about your mind, you have a vision of yourself. And you have a personality image of yourself that you've carried all the way through your life, you know, the sense of identity. You have to understand it, that the schizophrenic person is a stranger to himself as a stranger is to you, outside. There is no self in there. The ego is broken. And the person's own being is frightening to them and threatening to them like a stranger's voice. When they hear the voice in their head, it's like an alien thing. So then they keep talking about hearing voices in their head. And many will speak about hearing multiple voices because the fracture cannot just be in two parts. It could be in 50 parts for all you know.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So it's almost like two mirrors. Imagine in your brain, in your mind, you have two mirrors, both broken, but both reflecting each other.
What a mess. Anyway, yeah. You know.
This is what is happening.
Yeah.
This is what is happening. The ego has fractured and it is looking at its own reflection. And that reflection is looking back. So the person is a complete stranger to themselves who lacks this core identity. And they're basically empty and voided, you know. It's really a tremendous state to be in, and it's difficult to fix. And they're unable to live with themselves. They just in the same way that, for instance, say for instance, you've shamed somebody and you did some real dirty, you know, with a person at work or with a colleague or a person in a relationship. When you meet that person, you know, at some future point, don't you lower your eyes, especially when you know you're guilty? You can't look them in the face. Remember that old story about you can't look somebody in the face if you've done them wrong?
Oh, right. Yeah.
Right. Well, that's exactly the scenario that's happening in the mind of a schizophrenic. They cannot look themselves in the face. They're so guilty of what they've done and that they've complied and they've fallen from grace, so to speak, that they then live in this moribund state. And this goes for a lot of the heart. We only notice it, of course, when it's like Ted Bundy or Charles Manson or some other weird, you know, extreme case.
Yeah.
But we don't notice it when everyone is living like that, shoveling in the pills, shoveling in the medication, in order to, you know, conform to this image that society wants, and that the repercussions of it are just horrific, you know.
Yeah. Michael, if you just if we tie in the death instinct as well in regards to our so-called leaders of the world, it seems to me that that's something that they carry as well, and a side effect of that then might be that people, you know, who are looking up to these leaders identify with them, meaning that they also attain the same death instinct. They might even excuse me, they might even on a kind of unconscious level identify with these people because they know that they're in a power where they are slowly, you know, killing not only the earth in that sense, but the world and humanity's spirit is being crushed. So they identify with that because they're on the same level when it comes to the death instincts. What we basically are looking at here is a bunch of zombies running around and slowly just everything is being sucked up into a black hole pretty much, and no one really wants to live a proper life, if you know what I mean. And that seems to me to explain quite a lot of dilemmas that we're faced with in that sense, because everything is being just slowly cleansed and killed off, if you know what I mean, right?
That's right, and it comes from this identification, because like I said, you can either identify through love or you can identify through hate, and you identify with the object of your hate, the power that they have. They've also helped to rape your inner self, gut yourself, make you schizoid. Then you identify with the sort of bromides that they want, that you can have power, you can have status, you can have wealth, you can have celebrity, you can have all of these other things that they promise you. You identify with their power. This also causes it. Because they basically, see, like Viktor Frankl said, he believed in his theory of psychology that it was the search for a meaning that was the primal drive. Right? Freud thought it was pleasure, that man just wants to accept, you know, avoid pain and gain pleasure, not in some horrible way. It's a natural state to be in a state of always enjoyment, and pleasure was the primal drive, which he also connected to sexuality. You know, Otto Rank said it was meaning. As I said, Frankl agreed. You know, Karen Horney said it's the search for self-esteem. Adler, you know, Alfred Adler said it's the power. It's a power drive. It's like the sex drive, but it's a power drive. Nietzsche said it's will to power. You know, each one of these people has a primal motive that is at the root of all others. But if you believe that Frankl and Rank are right, then don't forget that meaning also can have many definitions. When you say the word meaning, it often sounds like it's something positive. But to answer your question, what is happening is that search for meaning can also be the search for the meaning that the system gives you. The medals, the kudos, the pats on the back, the success, the status, the celebrity. Now you can become a victim of this meaning to be a great charitable person, a great philanthropist, you know, a great inventor, a great hero, a great soldier. Everyone wants to leave their name in the blinking history books, you know, this kind of thing. Everyone wants to impress their girlfriend. You know, this concept is rampant. So you're not looking for the actual existential meaning. You've now been sidetracked into this other meaning, which is, again, defined by the world. Mm. And this, then, to do that, you have already put these guys on a pedestal and are looking for them to endorse that, because they will be the ultimate ones to look upon you. And the schooling teaches you this, to pass these exams, you know, to get these degrees. And again, this explains why people do this. Why have all the phenomena that you see in the world, from the schooling to the jobs to the military, you see, to politics, why is all that in existence? It's from the things that we're talking about and explaining. Mm-hmm. Individuals have given away their own sense of self-worth. And therefore, you're only now going to be dependent on the meaning that they give you. They're very seductive in this. Come to us. We will give you the approval. We will give you the knighthoods. We will give you the kudos. We will give you the exposure and the limelight, and people do it.
You know, in one sense, when you're talking about the slow death, the thanatos and the death instincts, pretty much, it also reminds me of the thing that it might also reflect the physical universe, because again, what we see externally then, or what they have been trying to do, is to make us identify with the external. But if we look at the physical world, for instance, we have things as entropy or the second law of thermodynamics, basically that everything is being slowly eroded away. It's a kind of a death process in the universe as well, if you know what I mean, taking place. Even simple things, that you have a fire and it will eventually die out, and the heat from that will be transferred into other systems, as they call it in scientific terms. But basically what it means is that it's up to us to put more, you know, logs on the fire. We need to revitalize these things all the time for it not to die, but that's not what we're doing. We're not revitalizing you know, our internal lives, so to speak. And I think that that's a problem too. So it might be that we're so identifying with the external world that we actually even come to adopt the things that we see happening around us, if you follow my train of thought there, Michael.
That's right. And when you are that collectivist, It's what your colleague is doing. Now you have to, you're into competition. Because remember, the system won't just allow you to win your stripes. It's going to put you through all these hoops. You have to compete. And this competitive man comes out of this whole Calvinistic model as well, in which you have to prove your stripes. You have to earn it. You know, there's a great quote from William Barrett, who was a existentialist writer. He said that so long as we remain in the womb of this externalized and public existence, we are spared the terror and the dignity of becoming a self. So just like, just like we say that people are seeking for meaning, or we said earlier that people may be afraid of freedom. That's exactly right. Yes. I mean, Eric Fromm, he wrote a book called Escape from Freedom.
Yep.
I've often spoke about freedom from freedom. What happens if that is the primal drive? What happens if you actually have a whole theory, a whole psychological theory that is completely contradictory to all others and says that man, the last thing he wants is freedom. He is wanting anything, anyone that can spare him from the weight of the freedom. And that will explain in itself neurosis. That's like already a theory of neurosis. And that when people can't get that, get what? Meaning, if you offer them real freedom and they can't get the faux version, they go neurotic because they're scared of freedom.
Mm.
You know? And of course, the real answer is it because they don't think for themselves. They have been so ground down to compete and to prove. How many fathers are telling their kids they're going to be failures? How many parents, you know, always telling you, oh, your cousin's so smart, you know, your cousin's a genius, your cousin's doing really well in school, you know, they're just wonderful, you're a complete idiot, what do you think you're doing, you know? And so, you know, you have this, and do you see that, I also call it the George Best scenario, based on the great soccer player George Best.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I've made an analysis of his life, you see, and others like him, and why they become alcoholics at the end. They have unbelievable talent. I mean, unbelievable, gifted. How many rock stars do you know? Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison's, the Brian Joneses. The list goes on of the great, great people who are in graves today, Jimi Hendrix, and yet they were in so much they couldn't control their so-called, you know, they looked like they were Dionysian and too over the top, and they couldn't control these addictions and what have you.
Mm.
This is all based on this. They had a natural gift and a talent, but they also had some tyrant leering over them, who a talentless asshole, like a father or God knows who. Just like you see at these pageants with these mothers who doll their little kids up in high heels.
Horrible.
I mean, we are surrounded by this. And they're bugging this kid. So the kid has lost his natural flow of intelligence. He's become mechanical. We were talking about the technological man.
Mm.
He actually has a gift that's coming directly from that reservoir of imagination and the unconscious. He invented it. He comes up with it. And then in move the demagogues. The demigods to tell you what you're going to do with this.
Right, right. And all the people, too, in one sense, hog that energy to instantaneously latch on to this person, actually kind of exhibit some form of genuine spark. You know, they're truly, in inspiration. They truly have something unique to give in that way. But the world clenches that, you know, very, very quick. And we get the Kurt Cobain scenario, you know, when they shoot themselves in the head.
Precisely.
You know?
Precisely. This is exactly it. And this can happen in multiple ways, of course. When you see there's something incredibly magical and powerful about the creative process, whether it's in a Beethoven or whether it's in a classical guitarist, or whether it's in Jimmy Page, you see. And the aura of that creativity and that flow is very powerful. If it's a master who plays the sitar or a drummer, there's certain Irish traditional folk musicians, you see, that I grew up with and inspired me in this way. And you basically see rapture on their faces when they're playing their instruments.
Mm.
And this is the flow. This is the total muse operating. That is very attractive to people, and they want to be around it, and they want to be near it, and eventually it becomes, you know, corrupted if those people don't hold on to their integrity.
Mm.
And the system will demand that you compete, and you do. And most of these people couldn't give a damn about money or fame or any of this stuff, but it's imposed upon them, you see.
Yes.
And then the result is, after living under that for 5 years, 2 years, 3 years, whatever, they suddenly can't resist, you know, getting into addictions, because the actual flow, direct flow that they had to the unconscious is blocked. So now they have to make up for it through speed and through drugs and through excesses, because now they are not getting fed by their own inner juices. So now they need to go to excess sexually and in other forms of debauchery, you see. This is another great tragedy that takes place.
Michael, in this show here and the previous one we did, we've been primarily looking at this from a psychological point of view or psychological perspective. the roots of Cherna, etc. But we're going to do a follow-up show here in a little while in regards to basically from the philosophical perspective. And you have some interesting ideas in something in regards to what you call the mysterium. Maybe you can talk just a little bit about this and give us kind of a little bit of a teaser, I guess, in terms of what we're going to discuss the next time we have you on, Michael.
Yeah, that's based on work I've been doing since about 1986, when I first went to... I've been reading philosophy all my life since I was very young, but I went academically, you know, or tried to. I mean, I'm a complete failure in school and everything, but there was a time in my life where just basically to have something to do. I did go to college in Ireland, just a regular normal college, and took a couple of philosophy courses, you know, for mm-hmm. 2 years. Mm-hmm. And that's always very good because there's quite a difference of actually studying philosophy academically as opposed to, you know, doing it at home and sort of just having a general interest and so forth and so on. And that was very productive. And so I've been studying from then onwards all my life and these types of theories. And I've never yet published or written or even spoken on the philosophical sort of perspective into the, you know, world dilemma, so to speak. I've always looked at it strictly from the conspiratorial point of view and the psychological point of view. But it's always been an interest of mine to also examine this from the philosophical aspect. And this is where I think is a good time now because I've laid so much of the groundwork with the other aspects, a way to look at it. Mm. It's another fascinating thing because I've always described this problem as a sort of a sculpture that you must walk around. You cannot be fixated on just one perspective of it because this thing is so multifaceted. It really is a gem, you know, that needs to be fondled and looked at in a different light all through your years of life rather than become dogmatic about it and say, oh yeah, I've got this number, you know, here is what it is, and then keep on, you know, sort of bashing that as if it's one thing. To me, it's very much connected to art of how you look at these things. And I also believe that a lot of philosophers, if you look into the New Age movement and if you look into the conspiracy movement, there's a lot of bashing going on of people who do not deserve it.
Any examples?
Well, Madame Blavatsky, Aleister Crowley,
gotcha.
Hegel, Heidegger, Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, right?
Yeah.
Taoism. We are living in a undereducated world. I always talk about that when you're in the conspiracy, you need to be much more smarter than anybody in Mensa or anybody out there in the technical world, because this knowledge is very eclectic for a start. It will make you intelligent. It's a very unique subject matter, and it requires a certain kind of perspective. You cannot drag your prejudices from the world and from the living room and from the pub into this world, which is being done over and over and over again. That doesn't mean that I'm exonerating the Hegels and the Schopenhauers and the Nietzsches. Sure. I know where they went wrong. Mm. I know what they've got wrong. But that's a completely different cup of tea than saying, oh, well, these are the brains behind the conspiracy. Or they're the ones who did this and they were the ones who did that. Or, they were just members of the Frankfurt School, ergo they had to be evil.
Right, yeah.
I am fundamentally opposed to that kind of thought processes, especially with ignoramuses who don't even know what they're talking about. It's always been a fascination to me, this particular aspect. And I believe that looking at the history of ideas to expose, like we did in the previous section here with Hegel, and show exactly why these people have some ideologies that are very perverse is also profoundly important to go into because it's, again, empowering. You know, it's what people should be aware of. It's almost like, let's put it under the context. I was talking earlier about how every psychologist is defined by the fact that they have a theory of neurosis. Well, my theories on the mysterium is exactly that. It's a philosophical as opposed to psychological theory that accounts for dementia and derangement and neuroses. Mm. And I believe that this... The heading I give to it is Disciples of the Mysterium. So, yeah, it'd be really great to do a whole talk on that. Maybe it would help a lot of people to even get another sort of perspective on this whole problem, completely unique though, because remember, philosophers in general do not, and I repeat, do not deal with a conspiracy. There's not one of them that do. In fact, the philosophical movement in general doesn't even acknowledge Ayn Rand. She's not even mentioned in dictionaries and encyclopedias of psychology. Omit her. Like the official ones don't even have a section on Ayn Rand.
There you go.
And she wasn't even conspiratorial. She was just a little bit, you know, debunking their systems, and they refused to accept it. So again, you know, my work is very much to fuse unlikely and apparently disparate disciplines and see what comes out of it, you know. So sometimes it's nothing, and sometimes it's really profound. You get these sparks that are really incredible. And I think it's really time now to bring out this whole thing on the philosophical take on it, the existential take on it.
Okay, excellent. Really looking forward to that. The Disciples of the Mysterium. Philosophy is very important indeed. So heads up on that program with Michael then coming up here in a little while. And we'll go more into detail into these subjects. MichaelTessarion.com is the website. Go there, check out his other websites and his work, of course, or Origins and Oracles, Architects of Control, etc. But with that, thank you so much for your time today, Michael. I've really enjoyed it. And looking forward to talking more with you then next time.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, Henrik. So great to get into all this material. Thank you so much for the time. Really appreciate it.
That's our program with Michael Tessarion. We will be back shortly with another program with Michael. Also see upcoming guests in our radio archive for much more. Thank you for being a member. We will talk more soon. Bye-bye.